Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
This is On Point. I'm Deborah Becker, in for Meghna Chakrabarty. It appears that women's health is having a moment, as they say. Last month, President Biden signed an executive order he called the most comprehensive action ever taken by a president on women's health research in America.
We've launched the first ever White House initiative in women's health research to pioneer the next generation of scientific research and discovery in women's health. Think of all the breakthroughs we've made in medicine across the board. But women have not been the focus.
That executive order allocates $200 million to the National Institutes of Health to research women and health, looking at topics such as menopause, endometriosis, arthritis, heart disease, and Alzheimer's disease. Many of those disproportionately affect women, especially women of color. Despite women making up over half the population, medical research did not routinely include women in large-scale clinical trials until 1993. Dr. Sharon Malone talks about this in her book, where she details how the medical system in America often not only ignores women, but she says it was never really built for them in the first place. Dr. Malone's debut book is called Grown Woman Talk, Your Guide to Getting and Staying Healthy. It came out earlier this month, and she joins us from Washington, D.C. Dr. Malone, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
So let's get back to that statistic about women not being routinely included in large medical clinical trials. How do you think that that has affected the health care that women get?
I think it has affected women's health care profoundly. I think the underlying assumption was that women were little men. And we are coming to the conclusion now that nothing could be farther from the truth. Women were really not routinely even studied. I mean, you think about the field of gynecology didn't really come about until the 1850s, and its start was rather problematic with Dr. J. Marion Sims, who experimented on enslaved women to really counter some of the obstetric injuries. And the problem with that is that before that, women were, you know, considered contemptible and not really worthy of study. And with that unfortunate beginning, we still have not advanced very much beyond that, because we still look at women as being just, you know, again, smaller versions of men. And most of the medical research that has been done on men and sort of titrated down for us.
Mm. And aside from research, though, there are other reasons, right, that keep women, especially women of color, from even seeking medical help. In your book, you write about your mom, who unfortunately died of colon cancer at a young age. You were only 12 years old. So what about some of these other reasons, and how have these reasons and this history influenced healthcare for women?
Well, if you are interacting with a system that really was not built for you, or thought, you know, with the thought of you in mind, we don't really have good, healthy relationships with medical professionals. And I think that was the reason that my mother lost her life. There is an education component, I think, for the conditions that affect us. We have to know what they are, what the early warning signs are, and when to go for help and to whom to go for help. And those are the things that we're missing. And I think that when you have very negative experiences interacting with medical professionals, and bear in mind, Deborah, my mother, you know, grew up in the Jim Crow South, where medical professionals were hard to access. Mm-hmm. She grew up in rural Alabama. So just the geographic inaccessibility was a problem. then how you were treated within that system was a problem. So it didn't make for the basis of a very healthy therapeutic relationship. And when you put that toxic mix together, I think that many women lost their lives because of not knowing what to look out for and what to do when they did encounter these things.
Right. And we're still, though, there's so much frustration with the U.S. healthcare system even now, especially for women. You know, we asked On Point listeners to tell us about their experiences, and we heard from several of them. I'll tell you. And I'm going to play a little bit of tape from some of the voice messages we received. On Point listener Tara Friedman, she's 46 years old. She's from Highlands Ranch, Colorado. And she said, when it comes to navigating this system, as a woman in the U.S., she feels like she's flailing. Let's listen.
I have long-haul COVID. I've had it now for 2 years, 3 months, 10 days. I'm perimenopausal, and I'm tired. I bounce around doctor to doctor. In fact, today I'm seeing 3 different doctors. Sometimes I'm listened to and cared for. Other times I'm ignored or dismissed or misunderstood. The guidance I get is oftentimes inconsistent or counters what other doctors have advised me. It's exhausting, and I'm just tired.
And of course, this sort of dismissal on the part of the healthcare system can have health consequences. We also heard from On Point listener Jennifer Vernon of Salt Lake City, Utah, and she feels similarly. She said one doctor in particular stuck with her. She went on a week-long camping trip. She wasn't feeling well. She went to the doctor. He said she was likely just depressed and she had a bladder infection. So he did give her some medication, but it didn't seem to ease her symptoms.
So a few weeks later, I went back. He said, go home and take your medicine. You're just depressed. About a few weeks later, I went back. And again, he said, you're just depressed. Go home and take your medicine and maybe see a counselor. So after 2 months, I finally went back and I said, I still don't feel well. And he finally did another test and I still had a bladder infection. From that experience, it affected my mental health because I didn't trust what my body was telling me. And I know I should have gone to a different doctor. However, I didn't know better. So I would really like doctors to listen to women. We know our bodies. We know when something's not right. And please don't tell us we're just depressed and take our medicine.
Dr. Sharon Malone, when you hear stories like that, those stories from our On Point listeners, I wonder what do you make of that and what advice do you give women to try to get their voices heard?
You know, when I hear stories like that, it really breaks my heart, simply because I think that we have a culture in medicine of not believing women. You know, there is this idea that women are hysterical or we are overly emotional or we are exaggerating symptoms for attention sometimes, and that's the unfortunate thing. And we allow sometimes the people in the medical professional to tell us how we feel. And I talk about this in my book. There is a sense called interoception, which is the innate sense that all of us have of what we feel like when we feel normal and balanced. And that's a sense that we should all get in touch with, because when things are awry, it signals. Pain is a signal, not feeling well, feeling off. And no one can tell you that you're okay if you feel differently. And I do encourage women. I said, if you are not getting the results that you want, that you really want from that interaction, it's difficult, but sometimes you have to find another doctor, because people that persistently put you off or minimize your symptoms sometimes can be doing your health a great disservice. I think we should listen to our bodies, and I think that we in the medical profession have got to start listening to women. And the other thing that really stuck out to me, if someone says, oh, you're just depressed, even if that were the case, being just depressed is not something to be brushed aside. If you are just depressed, well, then you should just make sure that those symptoms are addressed.
Mm-hmm. You know, you give a lot of advice in your book about keeping your body healthy, finding a primary care doctor, having your medical records, understanding your family's medical history, perhaps some genetic testing, right? And making sure you have an end-of-life plan. Basically saying, look, we're on new ground here. Everybody has to be an advocate. Would you say that's right? And how would you suggest that folks get into that mindset of making sure that they know how to advocate for themselves and prepare?
Well, this is what I would say. I wrote this book with a very specific intention in mind. And I think that most women remember and may even still have that book on their shelves, What to Expect When You're Expecting. Mm-hmm. And that was the book that women would go to. You would read it and come back to it on specific sections to read about what you might be encountering. Well, there's no equivalent of that for women over 40. And I wrote this book saying to myself, how about what to expect when you expect to live past 40? And I wrote it from the very beginning of explaining how to evaluate a medical system that has changed dramatically in the past 20 years. It is more confusing. The system is Byzantine, and I think even for the smartest of people, it is hard to figure out how to navigate the system. So I start with that sort of concrete information. What is important? How do you find a doctor? How do you assemble a team? Because I think that the things that have changed in medicine happened in the background, and most people were caught unawares. You know, Deborah, I had the good fortune of being able to work in one practice for 30 years. So I knew my patients. I had seen them through teenage years, through pregnancy, to perimenopause and beyond. And I had context for their symptoms and how to deal with them. But we are now living in a world where that is no longer going to be the case. Every time you have an encounter with a medical professional, you may see a different person. You know, you go to urgent care, you see one person. You go to your doctor's office, you see a nurse practitioner. So the only constant in that interaction is really you. And so what I want women to understand is that you have to be your own best advocate, because no one is going to be that consistent, is going to give you that consistent through line. But to be able to do that, you have to know how. You have to know what's important and what information that you are responsible for.
We're talking with Dr. Sharon Malone about her new book, Grown Woman Talk, Your Guide to Getting and Staying Healthy. We'll be back in a moment. I'm Deborah Becker. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG, or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm Deborah Becker. This hour, we're talking with Dr. Sharon Malone about her debut book, Grown Woman Talk, Your Guide to Getting and Staying Healthy. And Dr. Malone, before the break, we were talking about women becoming better advocates for their health in a medical system that's become corporatized in many ways and impersonal. But I have to wonder, it's putting a lot on the patient, isn't it, to be able to say, you know, yes, you may not be listened to and you may be dismissed in a lot of ways, but learn how to advocate and perhaps the outcome will be better. And it that may seem really daunting for some women.
And I understand that. And that is exactly why I wrote that book, because this is the reality. You know, I wish we could go back and do it the old way where, you know, you would have one nice family doctor who took care of you from, you know, from cradle to grave. It's just not the way it is. And I think that we can, you know, I've practiced for 30 years, so I've seen the evolution of what's happened to medicine. And it doesn't necessarily mean that it's bad, but I do want you to understand that this is what it is. So it is going to require more of you. You know, it is going to require you to advocate for yourself, because at the end of the day, no one cares more about your health than you do. And so is it going to require a little bit more homework and a little bit more prep work with you, you know, for you before you see your doctor? Absolutely. Because here's the other reality. If you get that precious appointment with a doctor, and you're going to have about 5 to 7 minutes of FaceTime. And if you have very specific issues that you want to address, then you have to be very efficient and organized about that FaceTime. Otherwise, you're going to leave that interaction and still not have gotten the answers that you wanted. So, yes, it's going to require a little homework.
Right. Let's talk about some of the specific ways that different health issues affect women. And one thing that you talk about in the book that I think is really interesting is stress and the effects of stress. I think most of us know that, you know, high levels of stress are unhealthy. But can you talk about that, how that is a specific health issue for women and what women might be able to do to mitigate some of the effects of stress?
Yes, stress. Everyone encounters stress in their life. We need the acute stress reaction. As you know, as I said, you've got to be able to rescue that baby from a burning building. You know, you've got to activate. But that you can tolerate. What is not healthy is chronic stress, which means like activating that, you know, your emergency system all day, every day. It grinds you down. It wears you out, not just mentally, but physically as well. You know, those stress hormones, the adrenaline, the cortisol that get activated when in stressful situations, you know what they do? They raise your blood pressure. They raise your blood sugar. They make you feel on edge. These are things that make you at high, give you higher risk factors for developing hypertension and diabetes. And when you activate these stress hormones all the time, what do? You eat more, you gain weight. All of it is sort of cyclical in terms of these stress reactions. And the people that experience the most chronic stress is really African-American women. There are so many things in our lives, be it, you know, work stress, family stress, financial stress, interpersonal relationships that are stressful. And that, if you tolerate that and don't deal with that, that stress, that level of feeling bad becomes your baseline. And remember that sense I told you about interoception, which means knowing what you feel like when you feel normal? Mm-hmm. Well, if you raise that baseline and being stressed is what you think is normal, then your body and you will ignore certain very serious warning signs for other diseases that may be problematic. So yes, stress is a problem. And we have got to figure out ways. We can't always control the things in our lives that are stressful, but we can figure out ways to manage how we deal with that stress. And sometimes it involves seeing mental health professionals. Sometimes it's exercise. Sometimes it's as simple as getting a good night's sleep or eliminating the people and situations in your life which are stressful that you do have control over. And I think we all understand that there are certain toxic environments that we find ourselves in that we perhaps should not stay there.
Mm-hmm. Because that can lead to some serious health issues that you write about in the book. And one of them that I found really surprising were the statistics about cardiovascular disease, right? And you wrote, in every decade of life after age 40, anywhere from 2 to 7 times more women die of cardiovascular disease than die of breast cancer. And most of the risk factors for cardiovascular disease are known and avoidable. So I wonder, and of course, again, Black women are disproportionately represented here. What are some of the things that you think women should know about to protect their heart health?
Well, I think that there are about five basic tenets that everyone should do, and it will decrease your risk of heart disease, it will decrease your risk of cancer, and decrease your risk of Alzheimer's disease as well. And these are basic things that we know, but we kind of go, oh, yeah, you know. Exercise is very important. Eating a healthy diet with as many processed, ultra-processed foods is important. Getting a good night's sleep, eliminating or smoking, simple thing to do, cutting back on the alcohol in your life, and again, getting back to this notion of stress, sort of trying to minimize the stress in your life. This has health benefits that will pay off in every aspect of your health, not just cardiovascular disease. But here's the other thing about cardiovascular disease that is interesting to me. That statistic that you cited, that, you know, at every decade in life, anywhere from 2 to 7 times more women will die of heart disease than die of breast cancer. And yet, we are not fearful of cardiovascular disease. Right. Because I think that we sort of think of cardiovascular disease as sort of an inevitable consequence of growing older. You know, old people get cardiovascular disease. Well, no, they don't. But the breast cancer story is, I think, something that we find ourselves victims of our own success in the breast cancer story. Because undoubtedly, the awareness campaign, early diagnosis, and better treatment has really raised the issue of breast cancer in every woman's mind. And that's a good thing. But, and here's the but, I want you to understand that more women die of cardiovascular disease every year than from all cancers combined. And it's just a matter of having some perspective on that. And we don't have to be fearful of cardiovascular disease, because there's so many things we can do to avoid it if we are careful and mindful.
And should there be screening, like there are regular mammograms? Could that help?
Absolutely, there can be screening, but I think more importantly, there should be more public education around cardiovascular disease so women understand the importance of cardiovascular disease and how it can affect not only the length of your life, but the quality of your life. And I think we also have this misconception that men have more heart attacks than women, and it's sort of a men or an old person disease. Not true. And there's also not really fully understanding that cardiovascular disease and heart attacks in particular present differently in women, which is why the symptoms and early warning signs are often ignored. Again, gets back to this feeling of if you're chronically fatigued. Sometimes chronic fatigue is a sign of heart disease, and we don't really recognize that as such. One of my dear friends is a cardiologist, Dr. Jane Morgan, who says when we talk about heart disease in women, we say that women have atypical symptoms, which, think about that language. No, women don't have atypical symptoms. Women have symptoms that are typical for women. They're only atypical when you're comparing them to men. And I want women to understand that in those 10 years, the 10 years after you've finished menopause, so after age 60, the risk of heart disease for women equals to or exceeds that of men. Fewer women are going to survive their first heart attack. And again, and the extent of disease goes on for much longer, often undiagnosed.
I wonder, if you think it helps to have more women as physicians? And I'm going to play another piece of tape from one of our listeners about this. This is On Point listener Margaret Racine. She's from Northern California. And she said she actually had a positive experience with one of her doctors. Here she is.
My first pregnancy, my doctor listened very well. It was a woman doctor, which I think has made a big difference in my medical care. I felt very well cared for each session. She answered any questions from the biggest to kind of the silliest about what skincare I could be doing. And she was really a huge advocate for me, I felt, by the end of my pregnancy, being a high-risk, obese, geriatric pregnancy.
So, Dr. Malone, encouraging story there from Margaret of Northern California. But I just wonder, you know, there are many, many more women who are doctors. Is it getting better?
Yes. I think that there is a component of empathy that most women, particularly in the field of OBGYN, have. Because, you know, needless to say, there are a lot of things that happen to women, and they are explaining to me, and if I'm a female physician, I get it. I understand it. I know what cramps feel like. I know what being pregnant is like. So there is that component that I think that we as women can relate to. But does that mean that men can't? No, I think it's just a little easier for women. But here is what, you know, I said we get back to the beginning. Even for women in medicine these days, you're still sometimes going to be faced with that 5 to 7 minutes of, you know, a FaceTime. And that's the hard stop against which we have to sort of make the best of this interaction. I think that men need to be a little bit more sensitive and aware. But I also want you to understand that for most women of a certain age, and that will be those of us who trained, you know, in the 80s and 90s, we were very much trained in a male-dominated medical field. So a lot of the things that we were told and the ways we were taught actually were things that were not benefiting women. And we were told many things about women, and particularly women of color, that turned out, now that you look back on it and you're like, oh, well, okay, well, why did we say that? The myths, the things that we attribute to Black women, that we attributed to just being Black, and the reality is, no, that's because they have a predominance of certain risk factors and socioeconomic and what we call the social determinants of health, mm-hmm. which are the circumstances around where people live and work, and that have nothing to do with the race of the person involved, but where they live in their environment, the things that are outside their control. So, you know, we've got a lot of unlearning to do, not just males, because I'm not going to male bash. There are plenty of good male doctors out there, but there is a natural, inherent tendency for women to understand certain things, and particularly when it comes to things like perimenopause and menopause. Mm-hmm. I have to tell you, you get way more interested in it when you have actually experienced it.
Yeah, well, we will get to perimenopause and menopause in just a couple of minutes. But I do want to, you know, it was fascinating to me when you said, well, when you were trained in the 80s and 90s, and many medical professionals were trained, and, you know, now you're at the peak of your career, right? Or maybe slowly winding down, and you've acquired all of this experience. There may be some unlearning to do. And I know you don't want to mail bash, but I do want to include a comment from an On Point listener that I think sort of shows what is in the system still, what kind of thinking might be in the medical system and what some women have to deal with. This is Janet Gaddy of Brown Summit, North Carolina. And she left us this message about an experience she had with a male doctor. Let's listen.
I was scheduled for a colon resectioning, and the surgeon actually took my husband aside and told him that I wouldn't look like I did before the surgery. I guess an implication that I would be scarred. It really stuck with me when he told me about it. It was even disturbing to him.
Dr. Sharon Malone, is there still a lot of that going on?
I hope not. I would sincerely hope that that is the exception and not the rule. However, is there still some insensitivity out there in the medical profession? Yes, there is. I think the biggest problem is when women are interacting with doctors, I don't think we give women the same amount of respect for their own agency. You know, I think mm-hmm. that a lot of times women are often told what to do and told what they can and cannot have as if, you know, we're living in the, you know, 1900s where, you know, there, dear, just do this and don't question me. And let me say, being in a position as a patient, it's intimidating generally because, you know, a lot of times you're not feeling well or you're anxious about whatever your complaint is. And it's very difficult to advocate for yourself, particularly when the interaction with the physician doesn't allow that or doesn't encourage that. So these are the kinds of things that I think are more problematic that we've got to step away from is to get physicians. We got to do it on both sides. We've got to get physicians to be comfortable with the fact that, yes, we are dealing with grown women who have their own agency and who might have questions, and to not feel threatened because someone challenges or asks you a question. And I think those are the kind of interactions that are probably pretty common because, you know, doctors are pressed for time. And I think they mean well, but the execution sometimes is poor.
Right, right. And so it's still being taught to patients in books like yours and also to doctors, you would say, right?
Yeah. I want patients to know, and the reason, again, it gets back to the reason I wrote this book. Sometimes you may know that something is wrong, but you don't know what is wrong about it or what to do about it. And that's what I want you to have, okay. A little bit of data.
Yep. We're discussing the new book, Grown Woman Talk, Your Guide to Getting and Staying Healthy. Dr. Sharon Malone is our guest. We'll be back in a moment. I'm Deborah Becker. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Deborah Becker. This hour, we're talking with Dr. Sharon Malone about her debut book, Grown Woman Talk, Your Guide to Getting and Staying Healthy. And we want to talk now about all of the attention that has been recently placed on the topic of menopause. And Dr. Malone is a certified national menopause practitioner. We should also say back in February, we did a full hour on the show about menopause, looking specifically at what happens in the brain during this life transition. We sat down with neuroscientist Dr. Lisa Moscone to talk about her latest book called The Menopause Brain. You can find that show on the On Point podcast feed or on our website, onpointradio.org. February 28th is the date to look for that show. In your book, Dr. Malone, you write that women spend a third of their lives in menopause, and yet there's not a lot of openness about this. So why don't you tell us, you know, is this just part of the continuing lack of information about women's specific issues? Or why do you think there's this lack of attention and information about the effects of menopause?
I think it's the perfect storm. Mm-hmm. I think it is, you know, menopause sort of hits right at the time where we are dealing with issues of ageism. We are dealing with issues of sexism. And I think it intersects with our attitudes about what women should expect as they age. And let me say this, we have really sort of normalized the experience of suffering in women's existence. Because think about it. We have, you know, as women, we have grown up. We have suffered through cramps, through pregnancy, through childbirth, through bad relationships. Everything about the language of how we describe our experiences through health is usually through the language of suffering. Mm-hmm. So when we get to perimenopause and menopause, we just think that's just the normal end experience of this woman, this lifetime of suffering that women must endure. And I think that when you get to the point where you normalize suffering, then you don't look for solutions. And let me say this. Women have been going through menopause for as long as we have lived long enough to experience menopause. Mm. And the reasons why we've paid so little attention to it, now that to me is perplexing because, you know, menopause is the one universal experience that all women born with ovaries will experience. I mean, you may or may not get pregnant. You may or may not have, you know, cancer or endometriosis. You will be menopausal. And so we have known what the symptoms are. We have known what some of the long-term complications and issues of perimenopause and menopause. And yet, we allow women in 2024 to enter this phase of life with almost no information. And the problem is that when they start to encounter some of the symptoms that we typically associate with menopause, such as hot flashes and mood swings and sleeplessness and lack of sex drive, and the list goes on, women have no idea what's happening to them. And they also have no idea what to do about it, and again, to whom to go for help. And that is the conversation we're trying to have now, is to sort of get women out of the mindset that suffering is should always be your default space, and also let you know what the implications are and what treatments are available for menopause and for perimenopause. Hmm.
You know, in your book, you mentioned that perimenopause can actually start much earlier than I thought. Can you explain, you know, on average, of course, there's like an age range. And I wonder if you can describe that age range and what some of those symptoms are. There are a lot of symptoms that you know, maybe that's part of the reason why there's confusion, right?
Well, there is confusion. And for those listeners who don't know about what perimenopause actually is, you know, we have sort of three distinct phases in our reproductive lives. Your premenopause, which starts, you know, from puberty through your peak reproductive years. Perimenopause is that change between, usually happens for women in their early 40s to their early 50s, and that's the transition to menopause. And menopause is the time, the age at which you've had your last menstrual period, and it is confirmed by having 12 months of no additional periods. That's how you know you're done. But those 10 years or sometimes even more in between does not have a bright signal that says, okay, perimenopause has begun. Sometimes it starts with menstrual irregularities that women will start to notice. But sometimes you can have completely regular periods and start having, again, hot flashes, mood swings, night sweats. You can have changes in libido, vaginal dryness, itchy skin, itchy eyes, brain fog, which is a huge one that happens. And what is happening in that transition is that your hormones are fluctuating wildly. And those wildly fluctuating hormones are really registering in your body physically and also in your mental state. Because the one thing that people don't realize is that menopause is not just a reproductive phenomenon. Menopause and perimenopause affects your entire body as well as your mind. And so the symptoms, being as varied as they are, a lot of times you don't think of it because you might be 41 years old. You're not thinking of menopause because you don't have an idea of what the entire spectrum is or time frame over which this occurs. And it, you know, it gets in the way of women seeking help, thinking that there are other things wrong. You might go to an endocrinologist because you're gaining weight, or you think that you have a thyroid problem, or you're depressed or anxious and you're on, you know, going to see a psychiatrist. And someone needs to, and someone, and that usually someone is your gynecologist, should be able to make sense of those symptoms and actually connect the dots. So women understand, no, I'm not sick. No, I'm not crazy. These are very typical signs of perimenopause. And should that person should also be able to explain to you what your treatment options are, such that if you don't want to feel this way and it's getting in the way of how you're functioning, then you need to know to seek treatment and care.
Yeah, well, let's talk about treatment, because treatment's been controversial. Hormone replacement therapy to try to get some of those hormones stabilized and alleviate some of those symptoms. You know, there was a big study done that said that hormone replacement therapy increased the risk of cancer. So where are we now with that as a potential therapy for some of these symptoms?
Well, where we are now is we have been trying to re-educate not just women, but doctors as well. Because the source of this bad information is not just coming from the press and the internet. It is coming directly from doctors who are still giving information out to women that says, oh, dear, you can't have those hormones because they increase your risk of breast cancer. And let me just say in short that most of the findings from the Women's Health Initiative, which was the study that was done 22 years ago now, that put that out there in the universe, that estrogen therapy or hormone replacement therapy increases the risk of breast cancer, mm-hmm. has been, a lot of that has been walked back. It was never as bad as initially purported. And what we also know and are coming around to the fact that there are many benefits to hormone therapy in addition to just relief of menopausal symptoms, but taking hormone therapy also decreases the risk of osteoporosis. It decreases the risk of type 2 diabetes. If you take estrogen and progestin, it decreases the risk of colon cancer. So the list goes on. And that message has not gotten out there. And we are really desperately trying to get women to understand that you should not feel as if you are taking hormone therapy, that you are somehow compromising your health, either in the short term or the long term, because that's just not true. It's been a hard message to walk back because, you know, it's sticky. It's a very sticky message.
Right, and frightening, right?
Yes.
I mean, I think a lot of people are probably afraid to experiment with something like that. You also say that most women should use some type of vaginal estrogen too, right?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Because, and let me make this distinction, because when we talk about hormone replacement therapy, we're talking about either systemic hormones, which means that you are taking estrogen and or estrogen and progestin. You take progestin if you have a uterus. Estrogen is the actual secret sauce in all of this. Mm-hmm. But what you're taking systemic estrogen for is for relief of menopausal symptoms and for the decrease in cardiovascular disease and decrease in the risk of osteoporosis. And that is really what women are taking systemic estrogen for. Now, local or vaginal estrogen is used for the symptoms of vaginal dryness, urinary tract infections, frequency, urgency, painful sex. That is what vaginal estrogen is used for. And even if you choose not to do systemic hormones, just about every woman should use vaginal estrogen because of the effects of the vaginal thinning and dryness that happens as we age, even if you've had not one hot flash, that almost 85% of women will experience the vaginal dryness, urinary tract infections, and urinary issues.
Mm-hmm. And I read that you said that some women, it's not uncommon for some women to become perimenopausal in their 30s.
Yes. Now, imagine this. Remember, if I told you that the average age for menopause, which means just having had your last period, mm-hmm. and that's where we mark it. Now, you'll be menopausal for the rest of your life, which is why I said that, you know, a third of your life you'll spend in that menopausal state. But if the average age is 51, and it's a little earlier than that for Black women because they tend to enter menopause earlier and experience symptoms that are more severe and last longer— But if you say average age is 51, and I tell you that that process can take anywhere from 4 to 10 years, that means that on average, women are entering perimenopause in their 40s, usually in their early 40s. However, suppose you're going to be menopausal at 45. Mm-hmm. Well, then that means that you can back that up another 10 years, and you might experience perimenopausal symptoms that we're talking about in your 30s. Mm-hmm. And this is where it gets really confusing, because a 35 or 36-year-old woman may go to her doctor and say, oh, my God, I can't sleep. I have hot flashes. I'm anxious. I'm depressed. And more often than not, your doctor won't even be thinking about menopause, because they go, oh, well, you're 35. And I'm here to tell you, you are perimenopausal when you are having symptoms. You do not have to wait until a particular age to age into this, because we are all going to experience our last menstrual period at different ages.
Another one of those, oh, I don't have to worry about that until I'm really old kind of thing.
Right.
So, you know, if so many patients are doing their homework, because they have to, Google, Dr. Google can be quite a rabbit hole, right? And there can be a lot of business opportunities for folks who might think that the neglect of some of these issues, the lack of time by doctors, really can open up some opportunities for folks to offer their own alternatives and supplements to help all of these things, especially for women, might help their health issues. So what do you say to women about, you know, sort of trying to figure out if some of these things that you see online that will guarantee that you're going to feel better and your symptoms will be alleviated, how should women evaluate some of those health claims that are being made all over the place, really, by some of these businesses?
Well, this is what I would say to you, because I think bottom line is this, particularly if we're talking about perimenopause and menopause, the most effective treatment for the symptoms of perimenopause and menopause is hormone therapy. And that is period, end of sentence. That is that we, a million different, you know, organizations, the North American Menopause Society, which is now the Menopause Society, and, you know, 30 or 40 other medical organizations have agreed that that is the case. Now, when you are out there looking at supplements and things and people are selling you things, I usually say the good rule of thumb is that if it looks too good to be true, it's either not that good or it's not true. Mm. So do a little bit of homework. And if someone is making these miracle claims, then you say, well, take a moment to say, okay, well, where's the data behind that? And a good clue for you is that if you are looking at supplements or things on the internet and they say it supports this or it supports that, because you can't say it treats it, because then you'd be a medicine. When that is the language that they use to get around having actual data behind their claims. So be a wary consumer. I don't think that the internet is a good place to go to look for a diagnosis. I think that the internet is a good place to go for information, not just data points, and to know that there are trusted people that you can follow on the internet that do give solid information. And I give some of those resources in the back of my book, because how do you know? I mean, people, you know, people can say anything. It doesn't have to be true. And it's just a matter of knowing your source, doing a little bit of homework. And I know I'm asking a lot of you, but it's important, because I think your health is important. And I think that I have the same goal that you have, and that is to make sure that you navigate this thing called midlife and beyond as happy, being as happy and as healthy as you can possibly be. And I want you to have the message that you do have some control over that. And I want to change the face of what aging and what midlife and what, you know, what a 60-year-old, what a 70-year-old looks like and what you should be able to do. Now, it's going to require a little bit of work on the front end, but it is doable and it is not difficult.
All right. Dr. Sharon Malone, longtime OBGYN and chief medical advisor for Alloy Women's Health. She's also author of Grown Woman Talk, Your Guide to Getting and Staying Healthy. That book came out earlier this month. You can find an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Deborah.
I'm Deborah Becker. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can Profit Motive Save the Planet? Is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or Environmental Social Governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits. So you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.